Blog Talk Radio.
Proudly brings to you Politically Direct, and I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 8th of March, the year 2018. Yes, happy International Women's Day, everyone. And of course, I want to thank you for listening from wherever you are, not just here throughout the Garden State, but of course, throughout the good old US of A. Again, folks, happy Women's History Month to all the ladies throughout the land, and again, especially happy International Women's Day here on the 8th of March. You can always write the show's inbox, folks, which is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at politicallydirectnj. Of course, you can also follow me directly on Instagram at @your_favorite_Fernando. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Fernando Uribe Jr. And for all of you Facebook subscribers, again, I ask you to please go to the official page for Politically Direct, like it, of course, and I ask you to tell your friends to do the same. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Don't be shy. Again, call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, our toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And as always, our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ every single day of the week, folks, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Again, www.insidernj.com. Start your mornings with the morning intelligence briefing provided to you every day by Insider NJ. Just go to the website, sign up with your email, and you'll get all the juiciest political news you'll find anywhere here in New Jersey right to your inbox each and every morning when you wake up, as you're having a cup of coffee or cereal, as you start your day. Make sure you start your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the sponsors, the journalists, or staff. Again, folks, I hope you all have any wonderful, you know, again, time during Women's History Month. Again, today, International Women's Day. Certainly want to honor all the ladies in our lives, from my mom to my grandmother, 99 years old, as sharp as a knife. My aunt, to all my female friends out there, again, it's your day to acknowledge all that you do for us all throughout the year, and certainly the significance and the accomplishments of women each and every day, not just throughout history, but certainly for the future. So again, happy International Women's Day here on Politically Direct. Folks, and as always, I'd like to get started with my first shot. Now, folks, you know, one of the things that came to my mind, and again, for most of us here in New Jersey, I know a lot of us were hit with really bad inclement weather yesterday, sometimes even a foot of snow, if not more, throughout parts of the Garden State, certainly parts of New Jersey that were without power. Certainly many college campuses were closed because of, A, the inability to get to campus for many students, and also, again, just because of this weather. We've seen trees knocked down. We're seeing roads that just aren't cleaned up enough for transit. And to be honest, it's something that's really chaotic, and we should be used to it here in New Jersey, especially with the snow that we get every year. But certainly a lot of snow today, looks like the forecast is telling us it's going to be even maybe just as big of a storm on Monday or Tuesday. So let's cross our fingers. Let's hope that that doesn't happen. Because between you and I, I'm done with shoveling. I'm tired of shoveling. I'd rather be outside somewhere in the Hoboken Pier, somewhere Pier 13 up here. Great spot, by the way. Enjoying some sun, enjoy some sangria, and not worrying about cold weather. But that'll come soon enough, folks. But as I thought about school closures, not just at the municipal level, whether it's elementary schools, middle schools, or high schools, I also thought about our colleges and universities here in New Jersey. And it got me thinking about sort of the struggle of today's modern student and thinking about what they have to endure when it comes to costs to go to college, what it costs to buy books, to register, and certainly everything in between. And, you know, it's something that it's personal to me because I remember moving away when I went to undergrad. Certainly it was expensive, and certainly when I went to grad school, you know, what we pay for tuition, for fees, you know, certainly I'm one of thousands upon thousands of people here in New Jersey paying back their student loans, whether it's their undergraduate loans for their bachelor's degree or degrees, or their graduate degree or degrees. And I really feel for students today because just the rising costs of higher education is just becoming, I think, too much for our students here in New Jersey. And it's really painful. It really, really is. And I have to tell you that it's one of those things that really, you know, makes me feel so much empathy for my students. You know, I teach out here at a community college here up here in Hudson where I live at. And, you know, I see what my students go through. And I'll tell you right now, I couldn't ask for a better bunch of students than who I deal with here at the community college here in Hudson, because I'm going to tell you something. These are people that are hungry, and they're very diverse when it comes to their age groups. It's not just your typical 18, 19-year-old freshmen that are just right out of high school, but we have people in their 20s and 30s, even 40s. I've had students in their 50s that were either working, were either laid off or retired, and they just said, you know what, I never finished school. I want to go back to school. I want to get my degree, and I applaud them. And I applaud anybody who wants to get an education because I think, you know, certainly getting one, I think, is a premium. And one of the things that I look at when I deal with my own students is how hungry they are and how hard they're working. And to say nothing of the fact that, you know, even here in Hudson County, the tuition levels for students here is still probably one of the more reasonable ones anywhere in the state of New Jersey compared to community colleges throughout, you know, the other counties here. In the Garden State. And, you know, one of the things that stands out for me is the fact that every semester, what I try to do is I do try to minimize my students' costs. You know, I try not to make them print too much. I try not to assign books that are overly expensive. Sometimes, you know, and I tell my students all the time, those are things that perhaps are out of my control. I don't always get to assign the books that are maybe more affordable. Maybe I'm trying to use an older edition and, you know, much to my surprise, the publishing company comes out with a newer edition. Happens all the time, folks, especially in the social sciences. You know, teaching sociology like I do, I mean, cultural textbooks and other textbooks for other sections I teach for other courses, I mean, they're always changing. So it's something that's out of my control. And I tell my students all the time, I'm like, listen, if I could assign a cheaper book, I would. And I feel for them because it's not just the cost of tuition itself, folks, but just think about textbooks. And I always, you know, and when I sit there during faculty meetings and I sometimes, you know, and to be very fair, I don't really like to talk too much during faculty meetings. I just like to sit there and get it over with because it's sometimes they're not very productive. It's just people going back and forth talking about stuff that really isn't relevant to the faculty meeting. But the point is that I sit there and when we talk about curriculum and we talk about textbooks, I'm always the first one to say, hey, can we find a way to like sort of lower costs a little bit? It's just like, and not that I get, you know, looked at with a very strange type of, you know, view, but one of the things that really just I feel for is having to sit there and then as I'm devising my syllabi for my courses every semester, you know, I sit there and look at the textbook. And I'm fortunate because I get to have the textbook for free, so I don't have to worry about costs. But that's not the same thing for my students. And I see them having to purchase 4, 5, 6 books for other courses. And I feel for them because I don't do that. I assign either one book to the most, and I try not to make them hardcover textbooks, obviously, but I try to tell them, hey, listen, if you can buy it online, rent it, I don't know, go on eCampus, whatever happens, you know, whatever you need to do, do it. I don't like to ever put put that burden on my students and make them sort of really come out of pocket. And it's funny to me because, you know, I was very fortunate when I was an undergrad and also even grad school. I was working. I was able to, you know, earn a living where, hey, that wasn't a problem. But not everybody has that. And I'll give you an example. I had a student that reached out to me, one of the courses I teach, said to me, and I remember, you know, he emailed me, and then I said, do me a favor, just call me. It's just easier. And when he called me, I can sort of hear the despair in his voice. He said, listen, Dr. Uribe, I'll be very honest with you. I'm trying to put my way through school. My family's trying to help me a little bit, but, like, you know, I'm paying so much for books for all my other courses, and I know your class isn't expensive, but, you know, I haven't had a chance to buy your book yet for the class, to pay for the exam. It's just one of those things where it's just like, you know, I either have got to pay rent or I'm having other costs. And, you know, I hear this and it breaks my heart. And again, not because I'm trying to sort of, you know, pitch, you know, a sob story to you tonight, folks, here on Politically Direct. I think what I'm trying to just illustrate is the fact that it's tough being a student. It really is. And as much, I think, sometimes as we like to get on millennials for behavior that sometimes we find irritating or annoying today in higher education, whether it's, again, at the undergraduate level or the graduate school level, I mean, it's pricey. Tuition continues to rise on our college campuses all throughout New Jersey, not just at the community colleges. I mean, I think here at Hudson, I think tuition levels have remained pretty steady. So in that regard, I think students are very fortunate. But textbooks still continue to rise. Fees get assessed every single year. And I wouldn't say this, I think, at the community college level. I think I say this more at the four-year college or four-year university level. I feel for my students. I feel for them because I've also taught part-time at four-year colleges and universities. And I see what they go through, and I see what a tuition bill comes out to in a single year. And then sometimes I think there are some schools here, folks in New Jersey, and I'm not going to be objective here at all. I mean, I'm a Rutgers alumni through and through. I'm devoted. My undergraduate degrees are from Rutgers in New Brunswick. My graduate degrees are from Rutgers in Newark. So I'm a Rutgers guy through and through. You know, I bleed scarlet red. So whenever I tell especially my community college students, I'm like, listen, if you're going to transfer somewhere, transfer to Rutgers. I mean, it's still perhaps the most affordable state school here in New Jersey. You know, maybe Montclair as well, because it's also a state school. It's also still very affordable. But the other four-year colleges and universities are just rising in cost, and they're rising just at such an astronomical rate that I feel bad for my students. And I'm hoping, and the reason I'm discussing this tonight with you is because I'm hoping that, you know, enough students and parents, if you can mobilize and talk to your legislators in Trenton, it's important to hold these colleges and universities accountable about their spending and why fees are being assessed each and every year. And I get it, folks. Colleges and universities in the United States have now become a business. The days of it just being an academic institution, it's one of those things that, you know, for me, you know, it's no longer, I think, somewhere where you go to learn. I think it's just somewhere where you just try to get a piece of paper, learn the necessary skills you want, and hopefully try to get a job afterwards. And in the meantime, you're being inundated with an enormous amount of debt, and I don't think it's right. And I feel for my students. A lot of them are, you know, going through 4 years of undergrad, and they're going to be graduating perhaps with almost six figures of debt in student loans, to say nothing of the fact of should they decide to go to grad school or go to business school or go to law school. I mean, you're talking about maybe an additional six figures in debt. And that's something that quite frankly they may never pay off for their entire lives. And that's really demoralizing. I think that's a really horrible way, I think, to live with that sort of student loan debt, you know, hanging over you. So, you know, again, I'm hoping that at some point there's a bubble that's going to burst. And I'm hoping that, you know, I'm hoping that people can just mobilize with their legislators and write to them, write to your state senators, write to your assemblymen, your assemblywomen, and tell them that let's hold these colleges and universities accountable here in New Jersey. It's becoming way too expensive for students to go to school. And all we ever heard growing up was, oh, well, you know what, you should want to go to college. The important thing is to go to college. You know, if you go to college, you'll be a success. Well, as we all know, folks, that sometimes that's not always the case. It certainly helps you. It certainly, you know, it doesn't hurt you per se, to, you know, get a degree. But in some instances, sometimes even getting a degree doesn't benefit you, because sometimes you end up pursuing a career or a job that you didn't even study for. So again, I feel for my students, as I, you know, sat, you know, not just yesterday at home, but today at home because of school closings. I just thought about that. I thought about, wow, you know, it's, and as I was grading papers and writing up an exam, I just thought about, wow, like, I don't envy today's students, because the amount of debt that they're incurring and what they're spending to go to school may not actually work out for them in the end. And that's, you know, that's really unfortunate. And that, folks, is my first shot. Again, folks, don't forget to call in toll-free tonight, 818-572-8032. I want to hear from you and what's on your mind about everything going on in the state of New Jersey. Again, our toll-free number, 818-572-8032. And it is brought to you by Insider NJ. Again, don't forget to check out Insider NJ every morning, folks, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Now, we do have our guest coming up in just a little bit. In the meantime, I do want to sort of go a little bit of a news rundown here, folks, on the program. And very, very interesting scene, some developments here. And certainly I'm going to keep it here local in Hudson County. Great article, again, from the website of Insider NJ, one published yesterday, as a matter of fact. And it really circles around some breaking developments up here in Hudson County concerning the Hudson County executive, Tom DeGise. And according to published reports, both Union City Mayor and State Senator Brian Stack and Jersey City Mayor Stephen Fulop have decided to bail on Tom DeGise in 2019. Now, let me just sort of paraphrase a little bit here from the article on Insider NJ. Now, State Senator and Union City Mayor Brian Stack and Jersey City Mayor Stephen Fulop are looking ahead to the Hudson County executive election next year, but not with incumbent Tom DeGise as a county executive candidate. Now, Stack and Fulop released a joint statement, quote, "With regard to Hudson County's next county executive, we wish to state that we are seeking a new vision that is more closely aligned with our governmental ideals. While we are grateful for County Executive DeGise's service, we look forward to working with new county government leadership that will complement shifts related to a growing and changing population, as well as an increased regional influence. Consequently, we will be supporting a new candidate for that office." Now, Hoboken Mayor and Robbie Bala and West New York Mayor Felix Roque followed suit, released a joint statement in support of Stack and Phillips' new direction, saying, quote, "We look forward to joining Senator Stack and Mayor Fulop in seeking a new vision for Hudson County government leadership. We will work alongside both of them as we seek a new Hudson County executive." Now, they're announcing on DeGise, who has served as Hudson County executive since 2002, when he won a special election, comes as Senator Stack is apparently the heir apparent to ascend the throne of the Hudson County Democratic Organization coming up this June, as he will succeed, according to most reports, former Assemblyman Vincent Prieto, who resigned on Monday from the Assembly as he takes up the reins as Executive Director of the New Jersey Sports and Entertainment Authority. Now, Stack's intra-county and intra-party rival, Senator Nick Sacco, also North Bergen Mayor, endorsed Stack for HCDO Chair in January, all but sealing the deal for Stack, and now the process of closing the doors on DeGise. Not so fast, though, says the county executive. Shortly after the Stack and Fulop announcement, he released his own announcement saying he's running for re-election in 2019 anyway, and later in the day, he released a first run of endorsements from Hudson County Democratic officials. Looking at these developments, folks, looking at the list of Hudson County officials that were showing their staunch support for Tom DeGise. Now, the first one that stands out is U.S. Representative Albie Osiris, up here in Hudson County in the Congressional District. Of course, State Senator and North Bergen Mayor Nicholas Sacco, Vail Mayor Jimmy Davis, and other Hudson County mayors, which included Guttenberg Mayor Wayne Zitt, Secaucus Mayor Michael Ganelli, Kearney Mayor Al Santos, Harrison Mayor James Fife, and East Newark Mayor Joseph Smith. Now, certainly, folks, these names perhaps may not add up the same to what we know is the opposing side in this little drama going on in Hudson County. I'll tell you, it's been a developing story that's really taken on a life of its own within the last 48 hours. And certainly with these developments here, you know, certainly not just hearing the news, and again, I'm certainly one that has taken a lot of people by surprise here, in Hudson County, and really throughout the state. I mean, folks, I mean, when you think about the Hudson County executive, I mean, it's probably one of the more prestigious positions in all of state government here in New Jersey. And shortly after the developments broke, again, the insider NJ, Hudson County Executive Tom DeGees emphatically stated that he is in, that he's running in 2019. And he said, despite the move by Mayor Fulop and State Senator and Mayor Brian Stack against the incumbent in the joint statement, he said that he's very much looking forward to running. DeGees went on to say, quote, I'm disappointed but not surprised by today's announcement, but it does nothing to change the fact that I'm running for re-election as county executive in 2019. I have run and won 7 elections in Jersey City and 5 countywide elections. And I'm confident Hudson County residents know my record and will continue to give me their support. Again, as I mentioned, he's been the county executive since 2002, with Stack's coming ascension to the chairmanship of the Hudson County Democratic Organization as it stands now. A party support deprived DeGees would have to run without the security of the all-powerful HCDO line. Now, as far as some could tell, DeGees' defiance in announcing he'll still run could be a power play move by State Senator and North Bergen Mayor Nicholas Sacco, which has over time been proven to be Brian Stack's chief rival, even in times of peace during the Hudson County political climate. For dominance in the county, it's a Sacco move against Stack. Now, Phil Zabinski, the DeGees campaign spokesman of Vision Media, the consulting firm that's closely also allied with State Senator Nick Sacco, said in a statement, quote, Tom DeGees has never backed down from a fight, and this time won't be any different. Many Jersey City Democrats support both Mayor Fulop and County Executive DeGees, but Tom is the only one who will be on the ballot in 2019. Now, DeGees enjoys widespread support among mayors and Democratic leaders throughout the county and the state, as well as core Democratic constituencies in Hudson, and especially in Jersey City. We're confident that Tom will prevail next year. And as I mentioned again, when he released his top list of endorsements, certainly State Senator Nick Sacco was at the top of the list, and so was Representative Albiel Sirius. And that was interesting, folks, because one name that has been absent in this entire scenario thus far, and again, things could change, has been U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. Now, it's very interesting in the sense that the senior United States Senator has remained relatively quiet throughout this entire ordeal. What I will say, though, is if you had to sort of bet some smart money here, and I'm not much of a gambler, you know, I mean, I like to go play blackjack once in a while if I'm ever in Atlantic City or if I'm in Vegas, but I don't like to gamble too often. I might play an occasional scratch-off game, folks, but that's about it. But if I had to put money on this, I would say that U.S. Representative Albiel Sirius probably would not have come out publicly for Tom DeGees had he not at least consulted with the senior United States Senator. I could be wrong, but folks, let's be very clear that Bob Menendez's influence and the impact that he has on county politics and even statewide politics is still very strong. Let me be very clear about that. And I'm not saying just because some people might just hear that today and say, well, you know, Fernando's a Bob Menendez guy and he's been seen to like have done segments with him and certainly has on more than one occasion demonstrated a public friendship with him very openly. Yeah, I get that. You know, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm a big fan of Bob Menendez. I always have, always will be. He's been a stand-up guy to me. He's been a stand-up guy to constituents here. You know, he's a Union City native. I applaud Bob. And certainly, you know, he still has significant influence and pull here in Hudson County. And the fact that he's, again, remained quiet, doesn't surprise me. B, it doesn't surprise me because he has his own campaign to run this year as he's running for re-election. So not to say that he's dismissing what's going on in Hudson County. He doesn't need to get involved yet. I don't think he needs to get involved yet to sort of put his name out there and perhaps cause a division, because we're seeing a division now in terms of sort of people, you know, digging their feet into the sand here. I mean, clearly we have two sides here that are, again, not on the same page. And you know, here in Hudson County, where there was relative peace between sort of the power brokers here in Hudson County, well, that's not going to happen anymore. I mean, clearly we're seeing the pretext for war here in Hudson County as it pertains to State Senator Brian Stack, also Mayor, Union City Mayor Brian Stack, and of course, North Bergen Mayor and State Senator Nick Sacco. So for those of us that know the dynamics here in Hudson County, that know sort of like the political scene and know sort of the backstory and everything, I mean, we all know that DeGees is a Sacco guy, and we know that Nick is someone that believes in loyalty to his people. He certainly has been loyal to Tom DeGees. Tom DeGees has been very loyal to Nick Sacco, I think also we look at the reality that U.S. Representative Alvio Ceres is also a very loyal guy. You know, it's one of those things about Cubans, folks. You know, being half Cuban, we're very big on loyalty. And once we have loyalty for someone, you know, through good or bad, you know, we're going to stick through them and stick with them. And I think that's what we're seeing here with U.S. Representative Alvio Ceres. I don't know if he's going to be now in the crosshairs of that alliance between Stephen Phillip and Brian Peck. We'll find out. But certainly the list continues to grow. And today the county executive wasted no time in releasing even more names that they're supporting them. And today, you know, again, another great article on Insider NJ today as a follow-up went on to say, one day after his political opponents launched a sneak attack, friends and supporters of County Executive Tom DeGees said they intend to rally behind him and announce the formation of the, quote, Jersey City for DeGees committee. The committee is composed of a diverse group of current and former elected officials who are supporting the county executive for re-election. Some of these names include Ward C. Councilman in Jersey City, Richard Borgiano, Ward D. Councilman Michael Yoon, Freeholder Jerry Walker, Board of Education Trustee Amy DeGees, former Jersey City Mayor Jeremiah Healy, former Assemblywoman Joan Quigley, former Assemblyman Sean Connors, former Councilman Peter Brennan, and former Councilman Ben Lopez. And, of course, additional members of the committee will be in the coming days. So, clearly, folks, we're seeing a line in the sand right now here in Hudson County, and we'll keep you posted, obviously, as further developments become available. Actually, folks, so we have a call here. I'm not sure exactly if it's our guest. I don't recognize the number, but we'll find out who it is in just a moment. All right, good evening. Welcome to Politically Direct. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Reverend Joshua Rodriguez on the line.
Oh, Reverend, hi. I didn't recognize the number. I didn't recognize the number you're calling from, Reverend. My apologies. I thought I was going to see a 201 number, sir. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Good to be on.
Oh, great. And listen, thank you so much for being a guest tonight. I know that you're a very, very busy man, Dr. Rodriguez. And, you know, listen, again, folks, if you're just joining us right now here at just about 30 minutes past the hour, it's my pleasure to welcome in the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez, representing the City Line Church in Jersey City, a great advocate for the Hispanic community here, joining us on Politically Direct. Now, Reverend, one of the things that stood out for me, you know, looking at your – you still with us? Reverend, you still with us?
Yeah. Yeah, right
okay.
Here. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I just went a little static. I wasn't sure. Sorry about that. One of the things that I noticed – Reverend, about your biography, it's really inspiring because I know that you've become one of the very vocal and preeminent spiritual leaders, not just in Hudson County, but throughout the state of New Jersey. And I know that for our listeners tonight, I know you have an extraordinary story in terms of your background because you weren't always involved in faith, right? You were someone that was working in the private sector. And, you know, it seems to me that you had an epiphany, right? And I think our listeners would definitely enjoy hearing about your story tonight. So how did you want to get involved with faith after so many years working in the private sector?
That's a great question, Fernando. Well, yeah, I worked on Wall Street for many years. I worked for over 10 years on the street. I worked for Prudential Securities running globally what they called back then their quantum portfolio management program. And I had just been introduced to Jersey City to work bivocationally with my wife at a small church that we needed to replant. And my career began to grow quickly at the same time the church began to grow. And I was sitting at my desk one afternoon with my, as a little boy, raised on the Lower East Side of New York City, coming out of the hood, out of the housing projects. I always dreamed of doing well and getting out of the project, so to speak. And so fast forward, it's 1996. My dreams are becoming true. I have my office, 57th Street and 5th Avenue, New York City, prime real estate. And I pick up the newspaper, USA Today, under the Bill Clinton administration. Our teenagers were breaking records. Teenagers were committing suicide, all-time highs. Teenage pregnancy. Teenagers dropping out of school, substance abuse, you name it, they were breaking negative records. And so my heart was torn. And I really can't tell you, I heard a voice, you know, from the heavens. No, not like that. But I felt convicted. It's like if I felt confronted with the headlines, and the conviction was this. I really felt that God in that moment spoke to my heart and said, hey, son, do you want to continue to build wealth for yourself and build, help the affluent become more affluent? Do you want to do something about this headline and give your life in order to change the destiny of so many of these kids, especially kids in the inner city that have so many disadvantages? I resigned the next day, and I had a dream job, so I gave my boss, Rona Gilbert, at the time, 60 days to find somebody to replace me. And I took a huge leap of faith to go into the not-for-profit sector now, taking 40% of a pay cut and doing something that was more rewarding and life-changing.
Well, I have to tell you, and again, you know, just reading about your story and certainly reading your biography before you coming on tonight, was it was really inspiring, because one of the things, Reverend, that quite honestly, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show tonight is, you know, you've become such a vocal presence, not just in Hudson County, but really throughout the state in terms of what you're doing with faith-based initiatives, certainly being a tremendous advocate for the Hispanic community, I think statewide. And, you know, inevitably, faith allows you to do that. Faith allows you to be able to reach a large spectrum of individuals. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you tonight here on the show, because it's quite honestly maybe a topic I think that's quite relevant, is there a lack of faith, you think, perhaps today, Reverend, in today's political and social climate, which probably contributes to probably a lot of the hostility we see each and every day? Because, again, I can't say that's the only explanation, but I would argue that's probably one explanation that probably goes unnoticed or not talked about. Am I wrong there?
No, I don't believe you're wrong. I think that one of the things that we have to do a better job at is understanding not just faith, but understanding our history. I mean, most recently we just had a pillar of the Christian faith, Billy Graham, die, and he was one of only two or three individuals that received the honor to have a viewing right at Capitol Hill. And one of the things that his legacy leaves behind is how it is that evangelicals are not to be co-opted by the religious right or moral majority or even by the left, but to take a stand for what the great sage of Galilee, also known as Jesus, referred to as the least of these. And so I'll give you an example. When you hear the term evangelical today on mainstream media, unfortunately, it's misused. It's misused because when people use the term evangelical, they think about people like me, when in fact, mainstream media is really meaning to say are white brothers and sisters who are evangelical. And so evangelical is something that unites people of faith since the Great Reformation that really see the Bible as the word of God, the cross as the center of our faith, conversionism as something that we're called to do, and activism as it relates to sharing our faith with others. But it's one of the terms that is most misleading today, unfortunately, in mainstream media. So when people hear that term, instead of thinking about people like myself and City Line Church and people of color, whether you're Latino or Black, and the work that we do socially, they immediately think of folks who have been co-opted and don't really practice their faith in a way that's honorable.
You know, it's interesting you brought that up, Reverend, because that's a fascinating point. And folks, again, if you're just joining us here a little past 33 minutes past the hour here on the East Coast, it's my pleasure to have on the program the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez, again, representing City Line Church right here in Jersey City in Hudson County. So it's my pleasure to have him on here. Reverend, one of the things you just said just a moment ago really caught my eye, because it sort of takes us back to an unfortunate reality that we see how faith or the idea of faith has become so convoluted, not just with mainstream media, but I think sort of like on a national stage. And, you know, I wanted to throw some stats at you that I found a little interesting as I was doing research for the show tonight. And, you know, as someone who's, again, a reverend and certainly one that is very involved in the community and in faith-based initiatives, when you see statistics or you see research saying that, for example, 20 years ago, the idea of atheism on the rise in the United States would be unheard of. That's something that just wasn't happening. But we're seeing more and more sort of like studies come out that more and more Americans are sort of moving away from religion and either becoming either spiritual, for example, where they're not sort of subscribing to a specific sort of religion or a specific a dynamic, let's say, of, you know, Christianity, for example. Like, you know, we're Latinos, right? So predominantly in Latin America, mm-hmm. you know, we grow up with Catholicism, right? So that seems mm-hmm. to be the preeminent religion that's practiced most often within Latin America. And certainly, you know, we've seen that maybe there's been a transition for many in the Latin community to sort of move away from Catholicism and sort of move into different dynamics, whether it's into Pentecostal or Episcopalian or Baptist or et cetera, you know, and or even just outright becoming spiritual, not subscribing to a specific religion, or even becoming outright atheist. I mean, a lot of studies are telling us that those numbers continue to rise. Does that concern you when you hear about these developments at a national level?
It does. It does indeed. For example, I did my doctoral dissertation on pastor's kids from the Northeast, specifically within a Latino evangelical Pentecostal context. And unfortunately, a lot of what we discovered from the studies that a lot of our very own kids are losing their faith. Some are embracing this thing called moralistic therapeutic theism, which looks like Christianity, but it's not. It's a form of spirituality that looks for seeks for a God that just wants me to be comfortable. So it aligns more with American pop culture. And it definitely concerns me. One of the things we learned from our research is that the reason why we're losing a lot of our kids to the faith is because they, number one, are looking for they're tired of phony, just tired of a faith that's not authentic. And so what we can do in order to save some of our kids is help them understand that to be a Christian goes beyond just going to Mass on Sundays or being part of a liturgy on Sundays, but it's something that you need to live out in terms of a practical sense. So it's definitely a concern. It's real. I believe the studies, but at the same time, I believe that one of the reasons why I gave up my lucrative career is in order to stop the bleeding, so to speak, and help our young people understand, especially millennials, that Christ is real, that Jesus was not just a historical character, but he indeed was somebody who drove social services. He drove social initiatives and was at the forefront of really serving humanity.
Now, Reverend, just to be clear, because I heard something in that narrative that caught my eye. When you're talking about, let's say, well, I'll sort of ask you this way. I know that up here in Hudson County, we know that it's become quite popular. Even in Essex County and Bergen County, we've seen a lot of community churches surfacing in the last few years. We've seen a lot of non-denominational community churches. Now, I don't want to name them per se, but I'm sure you know which ones I'm talking about, some of the more popular ones that have become quite prevalent. For example, in Hoboken, there's one. I know that there's a community church that's based out of Manhattan that has been able to cross the Hudson and go into New Jersey now. Are those community churches ones that concern you per se? Or because, again, you know, I've gone to those masses and I've sat through them as someone who considers himself to be pretty spiritual, you know. And I've sat through those masses where they're very animated. They're almost like musicals in a sense. And, you know, a pastor comes up certainly during Mass and gives, you know, a pretty inspiring sermon. You know, I can't lie and say I don't sit there and I'm not bored. But it's certainly very different than what we're raised with, you know, let's say being Latinos, you know, especially with Catholicism. Are those community churches ones that we should maybe be skeptical of? Because, you know, we find a lot of stuff on the internet and we find a lot of stuff that we can read about and, you know, certain words are used to identify what those community churches are. Are those ones that concern you at all? I mean, if you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what I would say is this. They don't concern me in the sense that Jesus said it this way while he lived on earth. He said, whoever is not fighting against me, whoever is not trying to destroy my teachings, he's not against me. And so let them be. One day God's going to judge us all for for the things that we do and the things that we omit that we should not omit. And so from the question, if I'm reading you correctly, there is something huge going on right now globally with the church and faith, and that's this thing we call branding. And so when churches, especially mega churches, become really big on branding because they're driven by musical groups that are known all over the world, they in essence come to all kinds of cities and inner cities with concerts, and then they launch from there. And sometimes the message is quite simple. And so I'm not concerned as it relates to the message. I am a little concerned as it relates to there not being some follow-up for people that really are looking for a genuine faith in Christianity, that want something substantive, something that's deeper. There I have a concern, because if I'm moving people on a basis of some good music, which we have, for example, at City Line, and a good word, which we have as well, people need more than that. They need to be grounded. They need some meat, so to speak. So in that sense, yeah, there's a concern, but we welcome them. I mean, we welcome them because I believe this, Fernando, I believe that every local church has something that nobody else has. And so that's why the Apostle Paul refers to the church as one church, one body, many members. And so every church has a different flavor, every local congregation, and there are folks that will never be able to reach. They'll never be drawn to City Life. Well, they'll certainly be drawn to all the kinds of churches, as long as they keep the message pure, genuine, like Billy Graham, where Christ is the center. I have no concerns.
Well, the reason I ask you, obviously, as a foremost authority, Reverend, is because, you know, we hear the word cult that's sometimes associated with some of these community churches. And again, I don't want to name them per se, but I think that, you know, there are some that, you know, there's one that originates in New York City, for example, that's become quite popular. And certainly other community churches, one in Hoboken, for example. Again, and I don't want to bash them on the program today. That's not my intent. My intent is that at times we see that word is thrown around to describe those type of specific churches. When you hear that as a man of faith, and again, as an ordained minister, when it's been brought to your attention, what's been a rebuttal you typically had? Or maybe it's never been brought to your attention at all. I don't know.
Well, you know, again, you know, as I think back on the legacy of Billy Graham, he was at Madison Square Garden for several weeks back in the 50s. And one of the things that he challenged the church as a whole on was a very subject matter that you bring up, because one of the wisest guys on the planet, Solomon, said there's not new under the sun. It's just a different season, but it's stuff that gets recycled on and on. And so we're always going to deal with organizations that perhaps present themselves as Christian. Forget about the name that they use. You can have the holiest name, the most attractive and appealing name, and have nothing to do with Christianity. And so when I think back on Billy Graham's legacy, one of the greatest messages he preached at the Garden had to do with what it means to be a Christian. And so if these folks pass the litmus, drawing from Bevington, and a wonderful scholar, English scholar, and David Bevington, and what he described as I described it before, the quadrilateral, describing evangelicals as people who are Christ-centered. So there's a cross. They believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And you, in order for you to come to Christ, you have to experience it. That has to be conversion type of experience. I believe that if these organizations, these institutions, so to speak, pass this litmus test, then we're fine. If they don't pass the litmus test, then that's when we have to be wary or concerned that they can be heading into some dangerous territory. The other thing that I would recommend is this: anybody listening who believes they're at a good, solid Christian church, whoever's leading that organization should be under somebody's accountability, under covering, so to speak, because that's what keeps us all healthy. When somebody can serve us as it relates to the checks and balances of our theology, are we preaching a gospel that's healthy? And so if those churches or organizations pass that test, then people should feel safe. If not, then they should really reflect as to where they're at.
Well, you know, Reverend, well said there, and I appreciate you giving us that clarity tonight. And folks, again, if you just joined us here 15 minutes 45 minutes past the hour here on the East Coast here on Politically Direct. It's my pleasure to have on the show the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez here on Politically Direct. Now, Reverend, one of the things about faith, and certainly with your church in Jersey City, obviously to no one's surprise, we know what a challenging demographic you must face there in Jersey City, as we know a very diverse socioeconomic type of dynamic that's existent there in Hudson County, and certainly in your time working with troubled youth. What have been some of the messages you've been able to convey to people from all backgrounds about the power of faith, and certainly what you've been able to do yourself personally in charge of City Line Church, and certainly everything you've been able to do statewide as, again, as a man of faith?
That's a great question. One of the things that we try to instill and impart to people is the fact that we're all God's children. And so we're all brothers and sisters, regardless of your ethnicity, regardless of your culture, regardless of your race. We're all children and of the same father. And so, as you know, Jersey City is the most ethnically diverse city in the United States of America today, according to many studies. And we're fortunate the City Line reflects the diversity. We stopped counting at 50, by the way, for Fernando. We don't know how many more we have. We know we have well over 50 different people groups represented at City Line. Now, that didn't happen by osmosis, because when my wife and I planted the church, I am of Puerto Rican descent. My wife is of Dominican descent. And the church represented mostly these two ethnicities. So we began to educate people and teach people, especially young people, that we're to respect our diversity and celebrate it, not use it to tear us down. And so we're fortunate to have a congregation today, because we've taught people to celebrate our differences as opposed to using them to tear each other down. We're real big on educating folks against stereotypes. And so at City Line, we have people who are Latino, who are Black, who are Anglo, who are Asian, who come from a Jewish ancestry or an Arab ancestry. And we learn to love each other and again, celebrate our diversity. But it comes with much work, because, as you know, people come with all kinds of baggage as it relates to, I was talking about this on Sunday, things that were instilled into many of our lives, but abuelita, like, no dañes la raza, don't mess up the race, which in essence is a discriminating way to say, hey, be careful who you bring into the family, because we don't want to,
yeah,
to mix,
yeah,
with the wrong
that
type.
Yeah, we
right?
definitely hear that, for sure, definitely.
Yeah, and so how do we bring people that come from different socioeconomies? You got to educate folk and help people understand that just because you have more resources doesn't make you better, or if you're on public assistance doesn't make you less. And so when you're able to educate people, and I'm an educator, and you're able to teach folks even from the inner city that regardless of what the studies say, they try to dictate that if you're born in this zip code, it's already a mark on your destiny. No, you can come from the Lower East Side like I did and go from the Lower East Side to Wall Street, to engaging in a lucrative career, and then give that up to come back to the inner city and help kids now make it out of poverty and build some amazing careers that will hopefully come back, and many have, in order to give back to the community so we keep building people.
You know, that's a great point, Reverend, and I'm glad you really illustrated that for us here, because I think it's important to understand that, you know, socioeconomic conditions do vary throughout New Jersey, not just Hudson County, but throughout all the other 20 counties in New Jersey that, quite frankly, each of them have their own challenging populations, and those that have a specific type of age demographic that do need help, that certainly faith-based initiatives like yours with City Line are going to be monumentally beneficial to them. So it's refreshing to hear the work that you're doing. And I also wanted to ask you as well, because I think it's a dynamic that maybe you come across quite often, Reverend, and I think it's something that perhaps has become quite dominant, I think, based along, again, age groups. I mean, I'm 42, and I know that growing up for me, like many in Hudson County along my age demographic, you know, we all grew up Catholic, right? And we all grew up having to go to Sunday school, having to complete those those classes to be able to, you know, go for your communion and then your confirmation. And then certainly, you know, you're raised with a lot of Catholicism in terms of your family background. And what I've seen in a lot of studies, and maybe you've seen it too, I don't know, but you could sort of clarify it for me. What we've been seeing, I think, for a lot of Americans for, I would say, 10 years now, is you've seen a different practice of faith, per se. Maybe sort of a movement away from the more traditional values that we've been raised with, and more Americans becoming spiritual. I'll give you an example. I was raised Catholic, and certainly like a lot of my peers where I grew up in Hudson County, for example, West New York, Union City, very Cuban, very Latin, Latino. Certainly, you know, we grew up with Catholicism almost pretty much in our face from a very young age. And as you got older and you read and you went away for school and you had different life experiences, you know, now being older, for example, you know, I'm very spiritual, as I know many of my peers are. Now, if you would ask me, well, Fernando, you know, do you believe in Christ? I would say, yes, I do. I believe in Christ. I'm one of those people that doesn't go to church on Sundays, for example, but I find it within myself to go to my local church, sit there in the middle of an empty church, maybe with nobody around, maybe the janitor there. You know, I sit there for 10 minutes. I speak to God, you know, say what I have to say, give thanks for certain things that I'm thankful for, ask for forgiveness, for example, ask for blessings, or ask for encouragement, and then I go about my way, Reverend. And I find that a lot of my peers, especially within my age group, I would say, you know, anybody I think above 30, I've seen this has become very predominant nationally, where they're becoming more spiritual. And not to say that they're moving away from sort of traditional religion, but they're just becoming spiritual. They're saying, you know what, I believe in Christ. I don't believe in sort of the conforming to some of the things I was raised with. And whether or not that's indoctrination or not, I mean, we can debate that. But the bottom line is there are a lot of studies tell us that a lot of Americans sort of practice what I do. And does that make me a bad Catholic, for example? Because, you know, I've heard that, for example. You hear, oh, well, you don't really believe in Christ. You don't believe in God if you don't do it a certain way. And my answer, Reverend, has always been like, that's nonsense. I think if I practice my faith in a way that I'm comfortable with, and I believe in Christ, then that should be enough. Where does that come from, do you think, the idea of like, oh, well, if you don't do it this way, you're a bad Catholic or you're a bad so-and-so? Where does that come from, Reverend?
That's a great question. You know, we have a rich history. Our history goes back now over 2,000 years. And, you know, the church gets birthed out of Jerusalem. The evolution that took place was amazing because it just went through all of Asia and then Europe and eventually it reached North America, South America many years later, and the rest of the world. And so, where does that stuff come from? Well, the original, you know, I'm real big on the law of first mention. When's the first time that you find a term referenced in history? And so let's look at the word church, right? The first time that we find the word church used in the Bible is in Matthew chapter, I believe it's 16 or 18. It's a reference to Jesus himself looking at Peter, and it was an issue of identity. That's the context where he asked him, you know, who do people say I am? And once he got the consensus, then he turns it on them, says, who do you guys say I am? That's when Peter receives this amazing revelation. And he says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so Jesus turns to him and says, upon this rock I'll build my church. And the word for church in the Koine Greek is the word ekklesia, which has nothing to do with liturgy. It has nothing to do with going to mass. On the contrary, it's a Greek word that has to do. Jesus borrowed that from Greco-Roman society. And ekklesia, where we get the word iglesia, our church, in essence was a group that assembled in the public square to deal with the matters of the city-state. And so getting back to your question, does it make you a bad Catholic? No. I believe that the difference between Christianity and a lot of world religions is that we profess to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And so should we congregate? Well, the early church, especially in the New Testament, Paul encourages the church not to stop congregating because one of the benefits that you have when you congregate, although every institution has its flaws, is that iron, the Bible says, sharpens iron. So we all need people in our lives to iron, to kind of sharpen us. Can you do that without the church as an institution? I guess we can debate that. But what's most important, Fernando, is that relationship, because you can be part of an institution and be lost. You can make that argument as well. So I would say that the most important thing is to have that relationship with God as a Christian through Jesus Christ, with the person of the Holy Spirit, and also understand that every institution has its flaws. Every local congregation has its flaws. City Line's not a perfect church, but we're doing our best to empower people and really help people learn how to add value to others by utilizing their gifts, talents, and abilities just to serve others. So it's not a faith and prosperity gospel. It's an empowering gospel to add value to others, to serve others, and to love others as you love yourself.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that, Reverend, because one of the things that I always find challenging when trying to discuss faith and religion is, you run into these speed bumps, and you run into sort of like these differences of opinion. And, you know, well, like, I'll give you an example. I remember, I would say probably for as long as I can remember, I think whoever I've dated has been, for the most part, much more religious than I am. And I'm very spiritual. I believe in Christ. But it would be interesting, and, you know, whether they were, you know, Eastern European, or they are Hispanic and they were raised Catholic or whatever, or everything in between, you know, I've had those discussions where they'll say, Fernando, you know, do you want to go to church on Sunday with me? And Reverend, again, and don't want to hang me here, but I sit there sometimes and say, you know, I'm not really down for it. You know, let's go have brunch. Let's go do something else. I worship on my own time. Now, don't get me wrong. I've gone to Mass plenty of times over the years because, you know, you go and, you know, you certainly want to keep the peace and harmony, right, as they say, right? So, and, you know, I sit there and then, for example, I'll have conversations, you know, not theological conversations, but philosophical ones with significant others, and they'll say, well, don't you believe in Christ, Fernando? I'm like, of course I do. I just finished telling you that I do. I just don't believe in him the same way you do. It doesn't make me better or worse. It just makes me different in the way that I worship. Doesn't it still seem to be a very big roadblock, Reverend, in terms of how we talk about faith in the public arena?
Well, it will be generationally, so that will certainly be a roadblock for the builder generation, my parents, or even some boomers. But I believe that because we're shifting as it relates to all kinds of ideologies and philosophies out there, I believe that for the Xers and the millennials, that's becoming more common. Again, I don't have an issue in terms of the different responses that folks have to institutionalism per se. But as a Christian, you know, the focus should really be on Jesus Christ, because, again, what makes me a Christian according to the Bible? Because when Christ died, they didn't even call his followers Christians. They just called them followers of the Galilean and followers of the Sage of Galilee. Christian was a term that was coined later on at a region in Asia called Antioch, where because the people assembled in public represented the lifestyle of Jesus Christ so well, that was when the term was coined. And so, again, you can be part of an institution and not look like Christ in any way, shape, or form. You could also be part of a community where, you know, you have Mass your own way, yet you're really epitomizing the life of Christ in a powerful way. But again, I believe it's a generational thing where different generations will respond to the point that you raised differently.
Oh, well said there, Reverend. Reverend, one of the things that stood out for me in your bio here, going back to 2006, I mean, what an honor. I mean, you were appointed the first Hispanic police chaplain in the history of the Jersey Police Department. I mean, what was that experience like? That must have been amazing, just to receive that honor, have it bestowed upon you. What was that like?
It was quite an honor. It was well celebrated. I'll tell you, it was certainly something that blessed my life. I had been mentoring cops for many years, and somebody let that out and shared that with the mayor at the time, Mayor Jeremiah Healy. and with the chief of police. And they told me, hey, there's this guy who's mentoring cops. Our demographics are shifting within the Jersey City Police Department. We're having more and more Latinos, and we've never had a Latino serve as a chaplain. But you guys think it's time. And so they came looking for me in 2006. I felt honored, and I went to serve them. It's been 11 years now, and it's been quite a blessing to be able to stand with men and women that are not perfect, but I believe we have one of the finest police departments in the country, where our men and women are trying to do what's right and really serve community and protect community regardless of their socio-economy or what they look like on the outside.
You know, community is an important word, Reverend, and I'm glad that you are emphasizing that word. And folks, again, if you're just joining us here at 9 o'clock on the East Coast here on Politically Direct, joining me, my guest at this time, the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez, representing Cityline Church in Jersey City, a great guest tonight here. You talk about community, Reverend, and the importance of that, and there's no question that we don't focus on that enough. I think whether it's in a challenging area like we live in here in Hudson County or in other parts of New Jersey or throughout the country. You know, one of the things I also noticed on your bio was just, you know, how diverse your speaking engagements have entailed. I mean, I'm looking at a list here of countries you've visited to, you know, in terms of engagements, my goodness. I mean, you're spanning the entire Americas here. If you could tell us a little bit briefly, I mean, what was that experience? I mean, I'm seeing you've traveled to Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Costa Rica, down to Cuba, to Ecuador, Ghana, Honduras, Mexico, Italy, Morocco, as a matter of fact, even Spain. You know, what has that experience been like for you to be able to travel the world, essentially, and as a man of faith and to really energize people from different communities?
Well, it's been quite an honor. I come from a home church on the east side of New York City that's called actually La Iglesia Cristiana Misionera, the Christian Missionary Church, and one of the impartations that I received from my pastor when I was a kid there was this amazing just desire to share by grace what you've received by grace. And so one of the things I've been able to do is travel to different parts of the world. To really do a lot of leadership capacity building, to empower others, to teach people, for example, in Ghana, how to not just change or shift a mindset from poverty to that of wealth, but also to understand that none of those things happen by osmosis. You need to take a hold of the opportunities that are given to you, and continue to move forward. If you're faithful in small assignments and you're faithful with a small business, you can build that thing faithfully to something larger. But it all begins, again, with just small steps. And so I mentor pastors all over the world. I mentor bishops and different leaders, and that's what takes me to different parts of the world. And we do a lot of social work in places like Morocco and Cuba. And it's just, again, just empowering people and giving them hope for tomorrow. You know, when I use the word community, I'm very intentional. For example, in Jersey City right now, as I'm sure you know, we have this amazing, amazing growth in the waterfront. And if we're not careful and neglect the poor, the whole city can be gentrified. And so, you know, we not just fight against that in Jersey City, but we try to empower people in different parts of the world, especially in large cities like Buenos Aires, so that the poor always look out for as well.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. And again, I mean, just looking at that life story, Reverend, I mean, it's inspiring in terms of, because listen, a lot of people wouldn't do what you've done, right? I mean, leaving a very lucrative profession, a profession that would amass you a good amount of wealth, to do this, I mean, the first word that comes to mind, Reverend, is selfless. And I have to applaud you for that. Not a lot of people would do that. Not a lot of people would make that decision. So I got to applaud you. And I know I speak for a lot of my listeners tonight, if not all my listeners, that have to be applauding at home while they're listening tonight, because that takes a lot of guts. And not everybody has that sort of like character and that backbone, but I have to give it to you. I mean, this is something that, I mean, it's inspiring me right now. to be honest. I'm not saying that to be facetious. I'm saying legitimately, like, I feel inspired speaking to you because of, you know, the differences you're making. I can see that. Reverend, one of the things that you touched upon before in terms of how faith is perceived on a national level, and maybe one that, you know, maybe this is a topic you haven't really touched upon too often with members of your church or others that you come in contact with, how demoralizing or how disappointing is it to you that on a national level, it seems to me, and again, this is maybe a cultural thing, and I don't mean cultural from an ethnic perspective, I mean maybe a sort of pop culture sort of thing, where it just seems that religion is really being minimized. And and I don't want to make the accusation specifically, but it seems like the mainstream media, which is predominantly very liberal, let's be honest about it, doesn't really, I think, goes out of its way to sort of minimize the presence of religion or faith, I think, on our national stage. Does that, you know, as a man of faith, does that infuriate you? Does it make you just angry with the way that many in the media portray faith? Or is it just something you just sort of dismiss and say, hey, I'm going to keep doing what I do, and I'm going to keep doing good, and that's what matters to me? How do you feel about that?
Well, listen, I believe that the Republican Party, they have done an amazing job at co-opting a lot of evangelicals, okay, but mostly white evangelicals. And so I believe that one of the things that, and again, let's go back to the term, the use of evangelical, mainstream media uses that term, they're not really referring to evangelicals, they're referring to white evangelicals. And white evangelicals that, in essence, most of them are not, don't have graduate degrees. And so that's what a lot of studies suggest. Now, the Democratic Party, on the other hand, has done an inefficient job at paying attention to the power of the evangelical vote, especially the black evangelicals and Latino evangelicals and even white evangelicals. And so that is disappointing. And one of the conversations that I am having right now with a lot of my colleagues who are national leaders and regional leaders of the DNC is how it is that they must do a better job, not just at respecting faith, but understanding that people of faith have choices. And many of them, historically, for example, were co-opted by the religious right because they portrayed two main issues, traditional marriage and abortion. But my generation, Generation X and the millennials, understand that we have more than two issues. We see the national budget as a moral document. We understand that if you're going to save the life of a child so that he is born or she is born, we've got to take care of that child from birth until adulthood. So for us, social services are important. Public education is important. Mass incarceration is important. Reentry is of critical importance. So all those things are important issues for us that have to do with morality and with godliness.
Well, the way you just described it right now, Reverend, I think resonates with a lot of people. But let's just say for argument's purposes here, that what we're seeing on a national level is, as you mentioned before, certainly the evangelical demographic in the country is being portrayed a certain way. But just in general, people of faith, what we're seeing, for example, more and more demonstrations on a state-by-state basis where we don't want to invoke religion into anything in government. We don't want to invoke religion in our government buildings. Mm-hmm. We don't want to invoke, you know, any appearance of faith within our school systems or, you know, just going into a government building where many would say, hey, listen, we've seen lawsuits being filed by groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union, other organizations, for example, that, let's say, represent atheists. When you see this sort of crusade, and I hate to use that word, it's probably not a good word, this sort of campaign, excuse me, when you see this sort of campaign being acted out nationally, and as a man of faith, when you see this sort of, and let's be honest, it seems that in some instances it's very mean-spirited, it just seems to be sort of like, not malicious, but just sort of confrontational about doing this, whether it's in our public schools or more importantly in our government buildings. How do you feel about that as a man of faith?
Well, I believe that as a nation, we need some serious introspection. We've got to look deep within our soul as a nation because we've been very hypocritical. I mean, think of it. Where were you? Remember, when I asked this question to people, they immediately remember where they were during 9/11. Okay, where were you? I didn't know exactly where I was. I had just left Wall Street. I was in my office in Jersey City, and I ran to the waterfront to pray as the towers were on fire. And so it's amazing, Fernando, that if you recall well, we've had this debate of separation of church and state in the last probably 50, 60 years only. And I say 50, 60 years because the church has always been involved in government, always. Part of our history. So going back to your question, I believe there's a lot of ignorance, and here's where the hypocrisy comes in. A lot of us don't know, we don't know the history of our country well enough to understand that schools, in fact, the government, Congress would legally print this book called the New England Primer. I have a copy of it in my office, as a matter of fact. It was one of the first books that they printed to teach our kids how to read and write. And it's filled with Bible verses, and it's the alphabet with biblical verses in it. And so there's something of separation of church and state. Sometimes it's hypocritical because after 9/11, everybody wanted prayer. Everybody wanted to bring God in to the scene, whether it's the memorial site at the World Trade Center or all of these different services. And so I believe that one of our challenges, and this is where the introspection comes in, has been that we've embraced in America, in the United States of America, Christianity as a consumerism kind of faith, where I'll use God when I need him, and when I don't need him, I'll just, you know, park him away, so to speak, put him on the shelf. I'll leave him there till I have another crisis. And so it's amazing to me how we respond as a society. We have a mass shooting, and we try to go get God and bring him back into the scene. Whether it's on Capitol Hill, whether it's in our schools, wherever it is. And so I think we have to do a lot of self-reflection as it relates to how we want to use God to our convenience.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's important to sort of illustrate the fact that we do that as a society, especially during moments of tragedy, whether it's government officials, whether it's members of the media, whether it is members of pop culture, activists, you name it. About invoking faith into the conversation, about saying, you know, we need prayers right now, whether it's a tragic shooting on a school campus or a terrorist attack here domestically or other random acts of violence that we see reported in the news every day. Reverend, is that more a reflection, I think, of just society for some time now that where we've become so desensitized of violence and sort of horror and tragedy that we've gone away from sort of embracing faith? Because after every school shooting, I read the news both left and right. I read everything in the middle. I read blogs. I read journalists, members of faith talk about, the absence of God in our public schools or the absence of Christ in the public arena contributes to this. Do you think that's being glorified, like as you mentioned, where it's just being used to a specific end, or is that a legitimate point where we're seeing a lack of faith contributing to sort of a decline in our society?
Well, I would say both. I would say yes, we are seeing a decline of faith, okay, and we are becoming more secular every day. But at the same time, as a faith leader, I need to own some of this. I need to take responsibility for some of this. And, for example, some of the most prominent universities today, Princeton, Harvard, they were birthed by the church. They were founded by the church because the church believed that we needed to have the most well-rounded pastors, the most educated pastors, to lead our churches, our congregations, our parishes. And so the moment the church stepped out of the educational realm, out of the different spheres of society, that's when we began to lose a lot of ground. For example, There was this thing called the Hayes Commission, and that was birthed by a Presbyterian minister. He wasn't a pastor, he was an elder of a church. And what this commission did was work with our federal government so that they could, in essence, control all of the stuff that would be put on television and on radio today. And so that was eliminated. I want to say that was birthed in about 1939. And in the 60s, I believe, early 70s, that was done away with because people didn't want to invest in that. And so it did not become a priority. And that's when Hollywood comes in and they introduce ratings and all kinds of different parameters are created for television, where I'm sure you've noticed there were certain words that could not be stated on public TV when we were kids that now are absolutely allowed. Because the church stepped out. And so here's my philosophy and my ideology. I believe that historically, when the church was involved in government, when the church was involved in society in the different spheres, whether it was the banking industry or public education or entertainment, society was more civil. We had less tragedies. We had less disintegration in our families. But the moment the church stepped out as an institution, then things have gotten more chaotic. That's my belief.
I agree with you. Listen, I'm totally with you. And as someone who, you know, sometimes, you know, I sort of get some backlash for maybe not being the most religious person. I'm proud of being very spiritual, but everything you just said right now, Reverend, was spot on in terms of, you know, your analysis. And, you know, getting back to what you do locally here, Reverend, and especially in Hudson County, you know, you've become such a fixture here also when it pertains to CityLine. For our listeners tonight that are listening throughout the state of New Jersey that aren't familiar with CityLine, could you tell us a little bit more about how you got involved with CityLine? What are some of the perhaps recent accomplishments that you can brag about, you know, let's say, about CityLine and all the good work they've done?
Well, thank you. One of the things that I guess distinguishes us as a ministry is that we try to help people that utilize their faith as something that they can put in practice in the workplace. And so, yes, we're a diverse church. Yes, we're multi-generational. But one of the things that really makes us proud is the work that we have as it relates to just empowering people so that they utilize their gifts, talents, and abilities, not within a church structure, but outside of the workplace, whether it's in public education or the banking industry. One of the things that really makes us proud are our collaborations and partnerships. We can't do it all alone. And so a few years ago, we began to build relationships with different faith leaders in the city and began to talk about community organizing. So we gave birth to this wonderful organization called Jersey City Together. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. But what we decided to do was do more collectively. And so CityLine was a big part of that. We're still a big part of that, where we, in essence, started out by interviewing 3,000 people in the city and asking them, hey, if you could change anything in the city, what would you do? And we got three basic responses, which were, hey, I want public safety and policing. We need safer streets. Secondly, we need better things for our kids as it relates to public education and recreation. And thirdly, housing and homelessness. And so as an organization that we gave birth to with other faith leaders, we've been working hard, really hard over the last 2-3 years to do this. We have about 200 acre lots in Jersey City, which, as you know, are gold mines in this development era in Jersey City. And we're working really hard to try to work with the mayor, work with different public officials to make sure that affordable housing is something that is included in whatever is going to be developed on those two sites. And so we're working really hard at this. And again, most importantly, helping people not to be religious, but to utilize what they have received by grace to give it to others by grace.
Reverend, what's been some of the biggest challenges maybe you've encountered in working within the county, whether it's with, you know, within Jersey City or in general with county officials? Have you run into any sort of roadblocks or difficulties in terms of working with county officials? Because that can always be a little dicey and complicated, right? I mean, usually, you know, you're trying to reach out to government officials. Hopefully you're optimistic that they're receptive to you. Any challenges you faced with that?
Not personally. I think that we've been very fortunate to have built relationships in the city and the county over the last 27 years that we've been pastoring there. And so we utilize those relationships, again, not for ourselves, but to empower others. And so we've had a great relationship with the county executive, with Tom DeGise, and with the last two mayors of the city, as well as the city council, as it relates, again, moving the people's agenda forward. And they've been very supportive of the project that we have right now that has to do with providing affordable housing so that Jersey City does not become another city that, again, is a tale of two cities. But no, I've not had any negative experiences. We've received a lot of solid cooperation from our elected officials.
Okay, well, I mean, the reason I ask is because sometimes, you know, when you're trying to work within the community, oftentimes, you know, you might run into some bureaucracy, and those are things that sometimes make it challenging for, again, for your church to prosper and continuing to, you know, be that strong presence in the community. You know, for our listeners tonight here, as 2018 continues, any big events coming up via City Line Church that our listeners should be aware of in terms of things you certainly want to promote and some big events that are really going to be extremely beneficial to people coming up in 2018.
I'm sorry. I lost you there for a second. Could you repeat that?
Oh, no, no. What I was asking was that as 2018 continues, are there any big events or any big milestones that City Line is looking to celebrate this year and really help promote for the betterment of the community, for the betterment not just of the members, but for people in general, in overall.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I look forward to doing in the future, Renato is coming back to you hopefully in a few months to talk about some initiatives as it relates to the Puerto Rican community. But for those of you who are out there listening who are either Puerto Rican or love the Puerto Rican community, I will mention that on March the 17th, which is a Saturday at 10 in the morning, we have the honor of being able to simply provide our facility so that folks who have been displaced from Puerto Rico and that are here, we understand more than 30,000 have come from the island because they've been displaced. You'll be able to come in and hear from different elected officials and community leaders as it relates to different social services and resources that might be available to you if you qualify. So I would say that's something that we have coming up. There's also a debt-free living conference that we have coming up on March the 24th. And so if you want to learn how to become debt-free and how to purchase a home for the first time, we're all about empowering community and helping people, again, move out of poverty and take ownership of their future. So, again, those in the audience, you want to learn how to become debt free, or you've never purchased a home, want to learn how to purchase your own home, you don't want to miss that. That's March 24th. It's a Saturday, again, from 10 a.m. to noontime.
Reverend, I mean, that's extremely admirable. I'm glad that these services are being made available to the community. A couple of things here as we're just about to wrap up here, and I appreciate your valuable time tonight, Reverend. I really, really do. And I thank you for really helping me create a dialogue tonight about the importance of faith and really dissecting this, I think, in a very intellectual way. You know, from one academic to another, I appreciate the dialogue tonight, to say the very least. I have to admit that. I know you're Puerto Rican, Reverend. What is the dynamic that makes you most proud to be Puerto Rican?
Wow, that's a good question, Fernando. Listen, I am. I'm proud to be a Boricua. I'm grateful that my parents left the island in the 40s looking for an economic opportunity that would lead to upward mobility. And so I'll tell you, I'm proud of being part of a society and of a group of people who are fighters. They're just fighters, you know. And so there's a biblical passage that comes to mind, and Jeremiah, and then Paul the Apostle borrows the term in the New Testament where he says that you can tear something down, but it's not destroyed. And that means that as long as we have ruins, in Spanish, escombros, we're not giving up, we're getting back up. And that's the picture of our people right now in Puerto Rico. We're resilient. And so we've gotten hit by a historic hurricane that has torn our properties to shambles, but we're getting back up. Puerto Rico se levanta. And so I'm proud to be part of a group of people who refuse to give up when all hell has broken loose and when all the obstacles are against us. We're rising up, and we're going to get back on our feet and make our island as beautiful as it's ever been.
Wow, you know what? Those are great words, and I'm sure for all our listeners, Puerto Rican listeners, I'm sure they have to be especially proud of you, Reverend, for, you know, that really convincing and very, I think proud narrative you just gave tonight. And right before I let you go here, you know, you've been a gentleman coming on the program tonight. I really appreciate your valuable time. At this point of the show, you know, after grilling my guests for over an hour, now it's your turn. The floor is yours. You can ask any question you want of me, because now, hey, listen, if I have to take it as well as I give it here on the show. So if I like to grill people, I don't mind being grilled back, Reverend. So the floor is yours. Ask away.
Well, let me ask you this, Fernando. What do you believe is one of the greatest gifts that you can give, especially kids in a city that represent my humble upbringings, kids that are living in zip codes where society's told them, hey, you live here in the zip code, you will amount to nothing, you'll never become anything. What is your message of hope to that generation?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Reverend. I'm someone that is a very dedicated, aside from being, you know, a very proud educator and a very proud college professor, I'm a very proud philanthropist. I take my philanthropy very seriously in helping different demographics and communities, helping women. You know, being today's International Women's Day, you know, it's a holiday that's special to me because, for example, every year I work very hard for the American Cancer Society and for making strides against breast cancer, to work for women and to work for families from all socioeconomic backgrounds. Currently, right now, I founded my own foundation to help create scholarships for students that are struggling to pursue higher education. I have my event next month, which, by the way, I'll be sending you an invite, Reverend, so I hope you can make it later on next month. I'd love to have you there. But I think it's important to give of yourself. You know, one of the things I tell my students all the time, Reverend, is I quote Gandhi, and to sort of paraphrase his teachings, he once said, you know, be the good that you want to see in the world and do good. And I remember that I've had some mentors always tell me some very valuable words. And it's one that I always convey to my students on a consistent basis. I tell them to dream. I tell them to try, to do good, to believe in yourselves. And if you do all of those things, you know, I can't promise you riches, as I say to them, but I promise you that you'll live as fulfilling a life as possible. And I think that, you know, being an educator, I take that as a very serious responsibility when I talk to my students about the importance of community and about helping those that can't help themselves. And here in Hudson County, for example, we know that, especially with the challenging socioeconomic climate, that it's important to do that. And if you can give a little of yourself and help others, it goes a long way, Reverend.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Fernando.
Well,
I appreciate that, and I appreciate that. Any other questions, Reverend? Again, floor is yours.
No, it's been certainly a joy, and it's been an honor to be on. I look forward to doing some good things together in the future. Again, anything that I can add value to our people and improve the quality of life of all people. Listen, I had lunch with a colleague recently, and we began to share stories, and we realized that we both came from really poor communities. Both grew up in different housing projects, him in the barrio, me on the Lower East Side of New York, and we were just so grateful that we were able to experience some a degree of affluence, and at the same time not be given to materialism, but understand that those are just resources that we can use to empower other people, and there, we were just so grateful to God. And so in closing, I just want to make sure people listening realize that, hey, I'm grateful to God for the life that I have lived and for the gift of just sharing with others what he's given me by his grace, especially the wonderful gift of faith through Christ, who's my Lord and my Savior.
Well, Reverend, again, you're an inspiring figure here, not just in Hudson County, but I would say throughout New Jersey and throughout the world, because you've traveled the world to really share the message of God and Christ, and I applaud you for that. And folks, again, I can't thank enough the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez. If you want to find out more about the City Line Church, you can go to their website, which is www.weareclc.org. Is that right, Reverend? Did I get it right?
Yeah, that's it. We
okay.
are CLC, CityLineChurch.org.
And certainly, please, you know, check out their social media. You know, again, I want to thank you, Reverend, for your valuable time tonight. I look forward to having you back on the show later on in the spring. I certainly want to follow up with you and definitely give you more of a platform, certainly. And, again, I appreciate you supporting Politically Direct tonight. If I don't talk to you again before Easter, have a wonderful Easter holiday with your family. Again, happy International Women's Day to your wife and certainly all the other important women in your life today. And I appreciate coming out today on the program. Best of luck, and we'll be in touch with you again soon, sir.
Thank you, my brother. It's been a pleasure. God bless you.
Oh, thank you, Reverend. Appreciate it. God bless you as well. Have a great night. Folks,
thanks.
Again, we just thank you, Reverend. Again, folks, a great interview tonight here. If you had a chance to check out the program, a wonderful appearance by the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez, again, from the City Line Church in Jersey City. If you're not familiar with them, definitely check them out, www.weareclc.org, a great local church in Jersey City, located, if I'm not mistaken, here, just in the information, at 1510 Kennedy Boulevard in Jersey City. So it's really down south in Jersey City, almost by the Bayonne border. Definitely check them out. A great organization. As I said, it's great to have the Reverend Dr. Joshua Rodriguez on the program today. And folks, again, that's who we bring you here on Politically Direct. We bring you these great guests. You know, we just don't talk about politics. We talk about the issues that matter to you, the Jersey residents, about faith, about community, about politics, about everything in between. And that's what we do here, folks, on Politically Direct. Now, again, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, you can always go to www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectnj. You can do so from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. If you have a topic or issue you want to hear about in the coming weeks, folks, you can write to the show's inbox, which is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly on Instagram @your_favorite_Fernando. You can also follow me on Twitter @FernandoUribe Jr. And folks, I can't say it enough. Do not forget to check out Insider NJ every single morning by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Again, if you go to their website, sign up for their morning intelligence briefing. Just sign up with your email. You'll get it delivered to your inbox each and every morning. So as you have your coffee, your waffles, your scrambled eggs, bacon, whatever your breakfast entails, start your day with Insider NJ. And again, folks, don't forget to like Politically Direct on Facebook. Appreciate all the likes and all the traffic on the show, on the page. Certainly the reception to the promo videos has been wonderful, so thank you. People sharing it all the time, and I really, really do appreciate that. And don't forget, whether it's on your morning commute, getting that daily workout in, walking your dog, doing laundry, even doing homework for my students, both past and present, for some of my students, studying for exams, make sure you do a good job there. I look forward to it. Tune in, and you'll be happy that you did. And don't forget, it's real, it's here, it's Politically Direct. Good night. Elizabeth, New Jersey. Central Jersey, getting some shout-outs here tonight here on Politically Direct. I'll see you next week, folks, here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.